Welcome to the Lending Forward podcast, brought to you by Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group. This is your home for real discussions about the mortgage and housing industry. Our hosts are here bringing you firsthand accounts from people at the heart of the business. And we're chatting with professionals from all corners of the industry as they help cultivate transparency around the future of the industry we love. Together, we are lending forward all we know to you. Thanks for joining us for today's episode. Let's dive in.
This episode is sponsored by Verse AI. Today, almost 50% of mortgage leads come in after hours and borrowers demand instant responses. Since 2013, Verse has helped mortgage pros close more deals with instant engagement 24/7 via text. Verse is a fully managed texting platform powered by conversational AI. Using AI, Verse engages leads via SMS, qualifies them automatically, and books appointments. By making you available 24/7 via text, Verse helps you outpace the competition. Verse includes CRM updates and integration, help with compliance, and customization. From lead to lock, Verse has you covered.
All right, welcome back, everybody. I am Bill Hitchcock, Senior Vice President of Business Development here at Atlantic Bay Mortgage, and I am super excited for our guest today, Ms. Julian Joseph here. We were catching up a little bit and we go way back and we'll kind of dive into some of that as well. We've got a lot to kind of unpack today and get into. So we're very excited. We know there's a lot of hot topics out right now, the 50-year mortgage. We're going to try and touch base on that and get into some of the different parameters. We also want to touch base on portable mortgages. We know that a lot of people are talking about that right now, and we are lucky to have such a wealth of knowledge. But I want to make sure that I do justice. So, I was looking over your bio as I was also kind of social stalking and seeing the different connections that we had out there. I saw UVA, right? I saw UVA out there. You guys broke my heart this year when my Florida State Seminoles looked like they were they were having their comeback year, and then you all had to go and literally take all the wind out of their sails.
Listen, every 15 years, I think we can have a winning season. So yeah. Sorry I had to start with you guys, Bill.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to you, but sorry for all the Seminole Nation. So just looking over your bio. So I know right now you're with JYJ Consulting. Is it?
Yes. Right? Okay. Yes, it's a consulting practice that I started after my time with the previous administration. Yes.
Gotcha. And so prior to that, like I said, administration. So you were former chief of staff to the HUD secretary, and that was under Marcia Fudge.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Fantastic. So that when you said you were in the administration and then you went out to start your consulting firm. Yes. Now, what kind of made you take that leap of faith and go out and do that?
Yes. Well, and of course, thank you, Bill, so much for the opportunity. This is so exciting to join you today. Of course, I served at the pleasure of the president as a political appointee in the Biden-Harris administration, where you just mentioned that I was the HUD chief of staff under the Honorable Marcia Fudge, who is a wonderful public servant, former public servant, and it was an honor to serve not only in the administration, but also to serve as her HUD chief of staff, in addition to several other seats. I actually, when I was appointed to the Biden-Harris administration, I was the deputy assistant secretary for single family housing. That's actually where I started running the single family office for FHA. And then through the course of the 3.5 years that I served in the administration, ended up as Secretary Fudge's chief of staff over the agency. But of course, being a political appointee, we serve at the pleasure of the president. And of course, our tenure ended on January 20th of this year with the changing of the administration. And in preparation for my what's next, I realized that there were a lot of people who were pleased with the work that I did, not only with the administration, but prior to. And I said, you know what, this might be a good time for me to just expand and spread my wings and start my own practice. And that's how we ended up where I am today with the consulting company.
That's fantastic. And you're also a living testament to, all of us that started off, originating loans, we can reach such high places that you've reached, right? You're an inspiration to everybody out there just learning how to use a calculator.
I appreciate that. And I can say that the core of all of the work that I've done has been the community and has been rooted in helping people. That has always been my North Star, whether it was in origination or being a housing counselor, writing policy on the state level, working at a trade association like the Mortgage Bankers Association, and even working with the administration. And it just naturally, the trajectory led that way. I tell people all of the time that the opportunity to serve found me. I didn't necessarily pursue it, but I think because of the heart that I have for the work, the trajectory just naturally took me there, and I'm very thankful for it.
Yeah, you know, with I think, you know, 20 years plus experience in what you were doing before, there's got to be those either that, you know, that thing or that situation that you look back at and you say that you were very, you know, that you were most proud of. And so much work around, you know, housing, that's going to be a continuous concern for, you know, not just Americans, really anywhere in the country, but, you know, being here where we are, it's, you know, that we've always said it's the American dream to have home ownership. So when you think back, is there something that you kind of say like, hey, I was most proud of this before you now made the new jump to JYJ?
Yeah, I think that there were two experiences. I believe that there was one that emotionally impacted me, and then there was another one from a policy and professional aspect. I would say from a personal aspect, it was during my time serving as a housing counselor after the housing crisis at the Neighborhood Housing Services of Baltimore, where I was a foreclosure counselor. And it was around 2010. And of course, you know, Baltimore at the time was ground zero for a lot of folks who had lost their homes or were in subprime mortgages and couldn't recover. And seeing folks at their lowest financial point, and for some folks, you know, in despair, became mm-hmm. my North Star for a lot of the work that I did after that point. Not knowing that at some point I would have to leverage a lot of that foreclosure experience, a foreclosure prevention experience that I acquired while I was a housing counselor when it was time to create solutions during the pandemic. You know, it was a full circle moment. So I think from a personal aspect, that impacted me the most in my career. But from a professional and policy perspective, I would say I championed the change for the FHA student loan debt recalculation policy. That was a very, very big piece of policy for me while I was working at the Mortgage Bankers Association. And I remembered how that the policy that was on the books, where it was the 1% multiplier of the outstanding balance, was very, very difficult in the approval process, mm-hmm. and particularly for Black, Brown, and underserved communities being impacted that way. So I had the opportunity of working under Bob Brooksmith, who is still the CEO and president of Mortgage Bankers Association, and he was a huge supporter of me working with the industry and creating a coalition of organizations who wanted to sign on in order to make that change. And I believe that that got the attention of Secretary Fudge and the Biden-Harris administration and helped them decide that I would be fitting in order to serve over the Office of Single Family and FHA. So I would say the recalculation of student loan debt is probably my proudest moment in my policy career.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, it's great that, you know, you can point to something like that. You know, we hope that we make an impact, and when you can kind of measure it and see what happens there, that truly is, you know, inspiring. So, well, we got a lot to jump into, and, everybody's going to hope that we can kind of break this down for them, but let's start right off, which is kind of crazy to think, like, I'm 55, and now we're talking about having a 50-year mortgage. So,
yes.
I know that you've been out, you've been, speaking and helping other organizations and kind of associations and companies see, I guess, the opportunity, but also kind of understand this. So, kind of tell us where this is coming from, and it may be too early to have a sense of, you know, where this will go, but, you know, any intel that you can give us on that would be fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I think that the motivation behind the 50-year mortgage is to create a mortgage vehicle that would provide affordability by extending, of course, the amortization from the traditional 30 that we usually see in the market to a 50-year amortization. I think on the surface, the intention may be good, but I have a couple of concerns, mainly because, you know, if it is being targeted potentially to the younger demographic of first-time homebuyers, we already know that they are averaging around 40 to 42 years old right now. And to talk about a 50-year amortization, particularly for the communities that may be underserved, who aren't beneficiaries of generational wealth, who may have higher LTVs, it could be burdensome and onerous to have a mortgage that is 50 years. We know with the 30-year mortgage in and of itself, you know, it can take almost 5 years for you to start to acquire some level of significant equity on the mortgage because you pay so much interest up front. But then you add a 20-year amortization to what the traditional 30 is,
right?
You know, we could be looking at 10 to 12 years before a borrower would be able to start to see significant equity that, you know, even if they wanted to sell for some reason, that they may even be able to break even. And then I think the other element to that is what pricing would look like. And I think that, of course, investors, if they were to participate in a program like this, I think pooling is going to be major. And I think that if there is an investor who would be interested in doing this, 50 years is a very, very long time to secure an asset. One, you have to pray and hope that the condition of that property maintains for 50 years. And then also we just understand that, you know, life can life. Pandemics happen, housing crises happen, and 50 years is a long time. And I would assume that investors would likely hedge themselves by making sure that the interest rate would accommodate the risk. So I'm almost concerned that by the time you price something like a 50-year mortgage, any benefit that may be, you know, that you may have by adding 20 years to the traditional amortization might be wiped out when you consider what the pricing could be for it.
Yeah. So Julian, so what do you say to when you think of a first time home buyer? Mm-hmm. And again, first time home buyers could really be any age. And that's right. What we're seeing now. But if you think you have a first time home buyer and they're thinking, well, it's helping me enter the market because my payment, you know, my payment is supposed to be, you know, lower. Is that enough to offset kind of some of the things that you touched on?
Well, I think being approved for a house is one thing, being able to sustain it is another. And I think that it's important that that the financial decisions make sense. And I think that, you know, with anything that you finance, the interest that you pay over the life of a loan must be a factor. And I think that the way that the first time home buyer enters the housing market and homeownership will determine the trajectory of their homeownership journey after that. You know, while they may be a first time home buyer, the decision that they make when purchasing that first home will determine how much equity will you be able to take to the next home? Or what happens if you start off with, you know, with a mortgage and you're single, but during the course of your, you know, the next 5 years, you maybe marry, or maybe you have a child, or you change jobs. So if you're in a situation where you're purchasing the home, but let's say you have to relocate, what does that look like if you haven't been able to accumulate enough equity in order for you to even cover closing costs or the
you could be upside down,
their concession?
Yeah.
You could be upside down in a mortgage. So there's a greater likelihood that a first time home buyer who, like I said, is not the beneficiary of generational wealth or someone who can gift them significant down payment would be upside down if they were to decide to leave that home within the first 10 years. And, you know, they are in essence handcuffed to that particular property because they can't get out. And I think that that in and of itself is something to take into consideration.
You and I talked a little bit before, and we were talking about how a lot of times, you know, we've seen this happen where a mortgage product comes out and somebody that was thinking of it, you know, was thinking, hey, here's the situation that will help. And it was just too early to see the impacts of maybe somewhere where, you know, where it wouldn't, or it gets that product is maybe right for someone, but it's not right for, you know, somebody else. Do you think that through all of the discussion right now around the 50 year that we'll see more from, you know, the Mortgage Bankers Association, the Realtor Association, more conversation around teaching people about, you know, equity awareness and understanding that that's really, you know, that's really where the wealth is, and that's really where kind of your strength is as a buyer, especially when you talk about people that maybe just didn't grow up with being so educated in that space.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that that's a great point, Bill, because we are definitely in a teachable situation right now. And I think there are a lot of elements within our economy that require us in the housing industry to not only be advisors, but to be educators, understanding that the mortgage IQ of every person is not the same. So I think that there's a level of sensitivity that needs to be given. And, you know, another thing that I would like to, you know, share with you and with your viewers here is that the age of the average home buyer isn't high by coincidence. I think that there's also an acknowledgement that needs to be made that a lot of the people who are borrowers today, the first time home buyer who is, you know, 25 to 32, could be the child of someone who lost their house during the housing crisis. Like, they were introduced to home ownership in a very traumatic way. So,
right, right.
You know, so if you, there's a level of caution that I think is coming into the industry, into the market, where there's a skepticism and there's a schism there that the younger borrower remembers an echo chamber of information that banks are bad and that they'll steal your house and they won't help you if you get in trouble and the products are dangerous. So now that those buyers who were 10, 12 years old in 2008 are now parents, or they are now gainfully employed, those are the professionals we're asking to enter the housing market. So I think regardless of how great the interest rate is, how great the product is, how innovative it is, how beautiful the house is, that doesn't necessarily move someone who has a level of, you know, subconscious PTSD that they're not even aware of, that makes them fearful to get into the ring at all. So I think that in addition to what you're saying, I think education is important, but I think that there is also a level of empathy that has to go into the conversation, that a lot of people are either boomerang borrowers who have been mm-hmm. hurt before and are just thinking about getting back into the housing market, or it's the children of those people who have been hurt in the past and they are choosing to rent because that is something that they can understand. So education would absolutely be a benefit more than ever now. And I agree that it takes the entire housing ecosystem, trade associations, consumer advocates, and lenders alike to chip in and educate so people feel more empowered when making that decision.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's really where we're trying to focus on, is that it's with all of, you know, with all this, we always kind of advocate for, you know, make sure you talk to, you know, get good advice, talk to an advisor, have somebody actually, you know, walk you through this whole decision-making process. And you want people to spend the time needed, you know, right now in such a you know, kind of a click for, you know, kind of a click and go environment that we're in. It's hard to get people sometimes to slow down and be patient and actually, you know, learn about the different things that are out there. And I think that this is one of them that all of the conversations are still going to kind of lead back to, you know, making sure that you understand what your finances are and your credit and your, you know, your ability to, you know, to take this on. And just because it, you know, is it today that it's going to be right for you? It may be tomorrow, it may be next year, but just building that plan out versus just kind of jumping in. Cause I do think if, you know, if this is introduced, we'll have people that will just jump in, you know, and just like, okay, it's something great. And those, a lot of times, unfortunately, that seems to be the group that is hurt the most, because there just wasn't that, okay, let's really think this through. So
yeah. And I also, not only, and we talked about sustainability for a second, but as someone who was responsible for creating the loss mitigation waterfall for FHA, if you have a 50-year mortgage, where do you go if there's a pandemic? What does a modification on a 50-year mortgage look like? Do we go 75 years? Like, right. You know, so it's not only about the purchasing of that particular MBS and putting it, if you make it, you know, I don't know, even know if it would be a QM mortgage, but if you do something like that, you then have to ask yourself, how do you service it? And if for some reason, which it sounds like, you know, we've already discussed that the equity is going to be an issue already. So what does modifying a 50-year mortgage look like if there's another health emergency or an economic, you know, downfall for the country, where do you take a 50-year mortgage to make it affordable if you're already at a, you know, let's call it an 8% interest rate already? How do you modify that? What does that look like at 60-year modification? I mean, so it's not only just getting into the house, but I also think servicers are going to be a huge, huge, huge player in this conversation as much as originators.
You know, there's a ton of questions that haven't even been asked yet, or somebody may be asking, but I know we brought up a lot of good ones. And hopefully more and more continue to happen around that, you know, and we'll kind of, you know, see where it goes from there. But, you know, the other part that I know that we wanted to get into was, you know, portable mortgages.
Yeah.
Why can't I take my 3% mortgage and just move it to another property? So, you know, can't you just stamp approved on that and make that happen?
Well, I will say, while a very creative proposal, I, again, from a servicing aspect, don't know how that would work. And two, I also, from a, let's just be honest, you know, lenders and banks make mortgages in order to make money. Mm-hmm. So if you're constantly recycling or kind of moving an interest rate, what does that look like for a bank who is not going to get credit for the origination of a mortgage? Does that mean that originations will halt for people who have interest rates under 4%? So I think that if anything, that could have a huge damper on the market if people can just continue to take their interest rates. Now, I understand, again, as we're talking about the 50-year, in theory, it sounds good, but I think in execution, it could really be an issue. I think primarily because, you know, the interest rate is usually based on loan to value. It's based on loan amount. Who's covering the difference? It's almost like an assumption on steroids. So,
right.
You know, but what would that look like? What does the mortgage insurance look like? If you get to take the rate, does that mean that the mortgage insurance will go with you? Does that mean that the mortgage insurers will now have to leverage themselves and hedge themselves because now the amount that was paid before for the previous house, there's now a gap there, perhaps. So do you then have to create a secondary market to now finance that gap between the mortgage that you currently have and the house that you want? So I think that, again, on the surface, you know, it sounds like, oh yeah, I've got a low rate, I want to take it with me for the rest of my life or for the remainder of that 30-year term, if that's what you have. But I think that there are so many other variables that came into place that were assigned to that rate at the time of origination that might not apply to the new property. And that could become kind of, you know, I get it. It's almost like a blockchain on mortgages. That's kind of what it is. So instead of being the property, it's on the rate.
And it could become problematic. But again, it's like I think our discussion is, hey, these are questions that need to be, you know, asked and answered. And I think to some degree, it seems very simple. I was, you know, talking to, you know, my dad the other day, and he was like, yeah, this seems like a great idea. But there's always, you know, what people, I think a lot of times lose sight of is there's always a domino effect. So if either of these products get introduced, there's going to be some other give and take from somewhere else.
Right.
Because it does kind of create a chain reaction, within all of the financial, engines that are, you know, that make the mortgage and housing industry what it is. We know there's these two products that are being discussed. Is there anything else that you think through these discussions here that you think will kind of, you know, more from them, that there'll be a third option that might kind of help, you know, create an injection into the housing market and also bring more people in by making it affordable?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there has to be a walking and chewing gum aspect to this as well, because, you know, while the focus is on affordability, yes, you want to make homeownership more affordable for people buying houses. But then there's the question of, what do you do for people who are already in them, who need their current mortgages to be more affordable? But if you put all of the emphasis on making affordable in the home purchase side, you then have to make sure you have enough inventory in order to address that demand. So otherwise, we're going to end up with another overheated market like we had 2 or 3 years ago, where there are so many people who are qualifying for a 50-year mortgage or a portable mortgage But now you're in a situation where there's not enough inventory and you've got people who are bidding $50,000 and $60,000 over listing. And now we have the opportunity for a bubble. So I think that that while the affordability conversation needs to be had, all of the emphasis can't be put on the access and the demand side without addressing the supply. So I think that it may be more beneficial to figure out how do we build more affordably, so that way when people are approved, they are not necessarily adjusting the product to high prices of homes, whereas you're figuring out a way to make home prices more affordable as opposed to coming up with products that are conditioning themselves to an expensive market. So I think that the only way that you can really do that is putting the shovels in the ground and making sure that there are products that are available to make renovation and development easier. And one of the things I've been preaching from the mountaintops forever is about the Neighborhood Homes Investment Act, NHIA, which is a great piece of policy with bipartisan support that's been presented, maybe introduced three times right now. And it basically provides a level of tax credit subsidy for developers who are building in low to moderate income communities. And they're concerned that if the improvement value doesn't support sales price, you know, this will provide a bit of gap financing for them that will make the property more affordable. And it allows them to continue to do good work in low to moderate communities. So it's something that's there that could easily, that again, has bipartisan support, that could literally pass today and help communities in the breadbasket and in urban areas in the tri-state. Like, it would work. And I think that the supply, the affordability question needs to be on sticks and bricks while we're having the conversation about creating, you know, finding affordability from the financing side. But I think if you make the building more affordable, then you don't necessarily have to create a 50-year mortgage to buy it.
Well, I just recently attended a builder conference, and there was a room full of builders that I think would be on the same line of, when you look at the red tape that they have to get through just to get a house out of the ground, there's so much cost that is there. And I think the more that we can truly help, builders build a product that is not, is not breaking their engine, then we create that affordability. You make every step kind of keeps getting us a little bit closer and closer. Mm-hmm. Because I think sometimes also there needs to be more conversation around how do we all kind of define affordability, because it could be look different to each person. Yeah. And it's really when you sit down and you're paying your bills, do you feel comfortable? Can you sustain this? Can mm-hmm. you still go out and buy groceries? Can you do the things that you need to do to have, just day-to-day life? And I think we have this dream of this two-story house with four bedrooms. Everyone has their own bathroom and, the garage and whatnot. And it may be more of a true starter home.
Yeah.
If builders are able to and willing to build, true starter homes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, everybody says what is affordable, and that's to your point. That's a great question. And I think that everybody kind of needs to do that calculus of what percentage of your income is being consumed with your housing cost and affordability. That's why I believe that HUD approved housing counseling is major. I think that it's very, very important. And one of the things that I want to flag is that people should do it before they start the process, for two reasons. One, it informs them and empowers them. So when they come into the transaction, the learning curve isn't as steep when engaging with their lender or their agent. And it also creates a level of accountability and empowerment from them. And I say always that it moves them from a posture of asking, what should I have, to saying, this is what I want. So it makes them more confident in the process. That goes back to those borrowers we're talking about who are a little nervous. And I think the second thing is it helps the transaction go smoother from the perspective of the lender and the realtor, that if they get the housing counseling done before, if you need down payment assistance or something else, you have your certificate when you come into the transaction, and it doesn't necessarily slow the wheels to a grind while trying to get to closing. So I think, and in that process, it's good for them to determine what their budget is and what they actually can afford, so they can manage their expectation based on that analysis.
Yeah, no, I mean, I couldn't have asked you to give a better public service announcement than that. You know, you just moved, a couple notches higher on my Christmas list. So that is that's fantastic. I can't believe how fast time has gone.
Yes.
I know that we wanted to get to conservatorship, but we might have to have you back on to kind of to dive into that. But I think, right now, these are two of the hottest, I think, questions right now on people's minds. I was joking with some other friends in the mortgage business. And they said, whenever can you remember people talking about, lending and products so much? You have people coming up and asking, what do you think about the 50-year? What do you think about
it?
So it's, it's made us interesting for a hot moment. But
yes, it used to be a time that we had to talk to ourselves because we were the only ones that would listen. But right now we've got folks who are not necessarily in our orbit who are just like, I'm hearing this thing about a mortgage. And you're like, oh, now you guys want to talk to us?
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, Thanksgiving will be fun.
Right. It's like, now you'll take my call. Sounds great.
Absolutely.
Well, Julian, this has been a lot of fun. It wouldn't be a Lending Forward episode if I didn't ask you, how do you want to lend it forward for the rest of the year?
Okay. I will say this. I think that I'm going to take a quote from my former boss, Marsha L. Fudge. And she would always tell us to always be kind to people, because when you are, they will always want to help you. So I think more than anything right now, we are battling apathy. And I think that it is very important, whether it's in your professional or personal life, to show grace and to be empathetic and to make sure that you're being kind, because I think that that is one of those pillars that will ensure that we all get through this season that we're in right now in one piece, and we'll all be better for it. So that's how I would like to lend it forward.
That's fantastic. And, I think it's just so simple. We're stronger together than we are alone.
Absolutely.
I appreciate you sharing that and really appreciate you being on today. Definitely want to have you back on. You are a wealth of knowledge. Congratulations on
all of
your achievements, being right out of Virginia Beach and this area and whatnot. I think that that's something fantastic. So very inspirational to all the people, I think, getting this business, to see that you can be in your role, but there's also so many different ways that you can kind of serve our industry and our community. So, Julian, thank you again for being on today.
Thank you. And thank you, Bill. And thank you to all of your viewers who are here for all of the amazing work. This is mission-driven work, and every decision that you're making is helping to impact generations. So thank you all, and much love to my hometown of the Virginia Beach area. I miss you guys.
Other than those pesky Cavaliers, love to everybody.
Wahoo-wah!
We appreciate
so much,
you.
Bill.
Alrighty.
Thanks again for tuning into today's episode of the Lending Forward podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our channel, follow us on Instagram at Lending Forward, on YouTube, and LinkedIn. Catch us every other Thursday with a brand new episode, and go lend something forward today. Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group, LLC, NMLS number 72043, NMLSconsumerAccess.org is an equal opportunity lender and employer. Located at 600 Lynn Haven Parkway, Suite 100, Virginia Beach, Virginia 23452.